Hi, welcome to Cheater and the Rude on PRN. I'm Jeff Kreisler, author of Get Rich Cheating, and now a special interview with Tony Hendra from This Is Spinal Tap.
As most of our listeners probably know, this is the 30th anniversary of the release of the seminal film of our generation, or at least one very good movie, and that is This Is Spinal Tap. This Is Spinal Tap was a satire of the music industry, or perhaps it was more than that. We'll find out when we talk to Tony Hendra, who our listeners know as both the co-producer and co-star of the Final Edition Radio Hour, and as the man who played Sir Ian Faith, the band manager in Spinal Tap.
I don't think Ian has been knighted.
I thought he was pretending to be naked at one point. How come he got to carry around a paddle? Isn't that only something...
That's just because he couldn't find his cricket bat.
All right, well, very well. As just regular Ian Faith, a man who should have been knighted, and you may remember some of his lines that are favorites of mine were, Boston is not a big college town, or don't worry, Boston is not a big college town, and the thing with the paddle. Anyway, Tony joins us tonight, as he joins us all the time, because this is a very... Spinal Tap, to me, was Spinal Tap, the Holy Monty Python Holy Grail, and Animal House. Those are my three movies.
The Trinity.
Of my... my growing of comedy age, I guess it was. Although Animal House always stuck in my mind more because there was a brief boob scene. But nonetheless, those are my comedy movies.
I would say that Animal House, it does fit in that in the Trinity,
sure.
Because it is actually it got a sort of bad rap in a way because it became seen as a gross-out movie with toga parties thrown in.
Right. People think of it as the frat movie, much like they think of Calvin and Hobbes as Calvin pissing on things when it's deeper.
Exactly, yes, exactly. I mean, its reputation was determined by its imitators.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was a very potent satire of further education in the United States. I mean, with the Dean Wormer, who's essentially Nixon,
mm-hmm.
who screws around with the Constitution of Faber College, and the ROTC, which is essentially the military, and so forth and so on. So it actually, but all of that was kind of lost under the welter of food fights and toga parties.
Right. Well, it was. It's also had its moment recently when people have talked about Harold Ramis's passing,
right.
Because he was co-writer of that. But no, it obviously resonated for more than just a brief boob shot with me. As did Spinal Tap. I don't think there were any boob shots. There was talk of greased-up women on all fours, but never any shots, which is probably just as well because that makes it more accessible to all people. In fact, I think it's still accessible to people, and that's actually sort of one of my questions I think our listeners have is Spinal Tap is in a short list of movies. I won't bother pretending to remember them. That has, I think, lasted sort of the test of its time. It's been 30 years, and I think it's still resonates even with people that didn't experience sort of what it was perhaps on one level speaking to, which is sort of coming out of the 60s and into the 70s and into this the 80s looming sort of corporate era of music and everything and making fun of those types of bands, and yet people still relate to them even if they never knew any of those elements. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's it's actually for several reasons, but one of the reasons I'd like to discuss tonight a bit is one that isn't, I don't think, talked about very much, which is that obviously Spinal Tap is on the sort of primary level a scathingly funny parody of the fecklessness and mindlessness of heavy metal, at least in its 70s incarnation. I'm not sure that it ever got into an intelligent incarnation. But on a deeper level, it seems to me it is a satire. I mean, it's not unlike the conversation we just had about Animal House, which is a satire malgré lui. So Spinal Tap, because it's a satire actually of an entire system, of the lifestyle, of its assumptions, its personnel, that helped to make the likes of Spinal Tap the cultural nadir it was, or as one NYU cultural studies course taught by a very, 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 very serious cultural studies professor called Andrew Ross, once put it, Spinal Tap and the Decline of Western Civilization.
That was, now is that a cause and effect
relationship? Well, yes, apparently, according to Andrew Ross, who is a Scot, by the way, and a very left-wing poet, left-wing Scot.
Was that, maybe you can tell me, is that because Spinal Tap finally said the emperor has no clothes and everything fell apart?
No, I think Spinal Tap was the meme, maybe, or the trope, or the tropey meme, or the meme trope.
The Treme.
Yeah, the Treme.
The Treme, I think that was that movie.
But it was actually, it represents the decline of Western civilization, according to Professor Andrew Ross. So anyway, so we have the parodies, obviously wonderfully carried off by the group itself, these lampoons of heavy metal's, you know, musical subgenres with all their kind of idiotic priapism, right. That's short for...
And for those few people who maybe somehow don't know the movie, also the big names, the additional big names, sorry, Tony, there were Christopher Guest and
Michael McKean.
Michael McKean. I love that Fran Drescher had a tiny bit role in it.
Yeah, the nanny, yeah.
And what was...
Harry Shearer.
Thank you. God, yeah. That's terrible.
Who is, of course, the giant of The Simpsons.
Yeah, yeah.
Voiceovers.
So for when he talks about how great they... I mean, it was great, the acting and everything, and I'm curious, we'll get to it eventually, how it all developed, but...
Rob Reiner, too, obviously, is possibly the most famous of all, and it was his very first movie. But the lampoons, the parodies are brilliant, and they're brilliant not only, like, because of their sort of ridiculous sexual... memes, but because of their pretension, I think one of the things that Spinal Tap caught wonderfully was the pretension of heavy metal, and Christopher Guest's character Nigel Tufnell, who is basically the most moronic of the three morons who front Tap, is also its most moronically pretentious with his wonderful work in progress, his trilogy in D minor,
yes.
Which has the working title of Lick My Love Pump.
His pretension is what led him to the great, like, this one goes to 11 scene. It shattered his, he was professing such grand ambitions, and yet he didn't. This one goes to 11.
This one goes to 11. Yes, exactly. And of course, actually, Stonehenge is immensely pretentious too, mm-hmm. and it's kind of gone down in film history as an epic stage fail. But really, its lyrics and effects are just as funny because they perfectly embody that kind of awful, flaccid Lord of the Rings-driven Celtic, Nordic, Aryan race memory fantasies, you know, that heavy metal loves to wallow in. There's that great line, he says, they're druids. Nobody knows who they were or what they were doing. It's just hilarious.
Well, it fits in also to that thing that they have earlier about having all the appealing to all the male teenagers as their audience.
Right.
I forget if that was in the scene when he had the
retarded conflict. Sexuality, I think.
Right,
was
exactly.
Right.
The same thing. The same people go for the belief in the druids and the Dungeons and Dragons as a greater...
Absolutely, the ocean of retarded sexuality. But the thing is that surrounding these wonderful parodies is this kind of 360-degree satire of the industry which brought us rock and fed off it, both while it was alive and well and when it was a fly-blown corpse. So... And basically, no rock, if you'll forgive the expression, is left unturned during Tap's pathetic journey. And all the slimy things under each one of them are given ample room to slime themselves into movie legend. There's you mentioned Fran Drescher, whose character name is Bobby Fleckman,
mm-hmm.
and she has that wonderful sort of New York, whiny New York voice.
Perfect little publicist-ish type, I forget that was exactly her role. But.
And she is, she's certainly a part of the slime monument that is Polymer Records. And then there's Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg, of course, who is founder of Hogwood, which is his summer camp for pale young boys. And even Howard Hessman. I don't know if Howard Hessman played Terry Ladd.
He was the manager of the other band, right, that they came across? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, in Memphis. And in fact, the other band was fronted, the star was Duke Fame. And Duke Fame had been one of the many, many members of Spinal Tap. And what was great about that scene was that Duke Fame is equally talentless. I mean, he's just
sure.
He's just as much a sort of bottom feeder as Tap is, but he happens to be on the upswing. So Howard Hessman won't let Spinal Tap touch him, and then he sort of gets out of an awkward situation where Ian comes up with a shit-eating grin on his face and says, "Terry," and Terry goes, "Liam." Liam, and Ian has to go. No, Ian, and it's exactly what happens with the slime balls when they meet one another.
I know that too well. I think in a way that's kind of what people can relate to is that slime balls are in every industry, but they wear more leathery pants and
yeah,
one.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think actually they changed at all, but I'll get to that point later. But I think my favorite is Paul Schaefer's Artie Fufkin,
mm-hmm.
the A&R guy in Milwaukee or wherever it is, who shows up at the
it was a book signing, not a book signing.
Not a book signing, a record signing.
I'm getting behind myself.
Two authors, indeed. But he shows up at the record store and eventually, having tried to blame the owner of the record store for the fact that none of the public has shown up to allow Tap to sign their records, actually blames himself in this marvelous burst of passive aggression and says, well, here it is, what he says. And that a clip goes here.
Yeah. Let me ask, how much, I mean, I know where I'm taking us off your train of thought, but how much of this was improvised and how much of it was scripted? I know that's probably, you get that question all the time, but when you think about this, the whole sort of a large genre of sort of, people think of it in Christopher Guest terms, but like his work, some of times it's improvised. I mean, it's obviously not completely, but was Spinal Tap, like, was that line scripted or was that something that he felt in that moment, if you can remember, or...
No, I'm pretty, as far as I know, practically everything, every line in the movie is ad-libbed, including, including obviously the band's one-liners. I mean, those were things I mean, obviously there were stage things like going to 11 because they had to build the set. But what Harry, Rob, Christopher, and Michael had done was to write what used to be called a scenario.
Sure.
A scenario is literally a scene-by-scene breakdown. So that they, conceptually, all the things that were in the movie were somewhere in that scenario. Although there were quite a number of scenes that we shot that,
sure.
Never actually made it into the movie.
That'd be fascinating.
But once you were in a scene... It was the job of whoever was in the scene to get from point A to point B, and so that's where all these wonderful lines came from. So Artie Fufkin, Paul Schaefer, had the job I'm not even sure he had to take the blame for it, but he had the job of trying to sort of keep the record industry end up when obviously they had screwed up in a monumental fashion. Right. So that's how he chose.
Well, to me, as a writer / performer, whatever I am, that was one of the fascinating things because I don't think that those types of works were being done that much then. And correct me if I'm wrong, that sort of free reign.
Oh, not at all. No, I don't think anyone had tried to do this before.
Right. And it just shows sort of, I mean, obviously ahead of its time isn't even the right term because now there's more of that happening as improv and the UCBs and the Groundlings and all that have sort of gained more acceptance throughout the industry. People are sort of working with that structure more, but that was really, as far as I, one of the first, if not the first, that really sort of used that structure. And you trusted the talent and you trusted the intelligence of people's ability to really understand and embrace his character, and perhaps because the satire was so deep and so rooted in the truth that it was easy to become these real characters that then could have these scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually one of the reasons why there's never been a sequel or, in fact, an effective imitation of it is that it was very much of a certain moment, and I think everybody in the movie, every actor in the movie, was sort of in some either superficial or profound way, disappointed with rock and roll. And it was that moment where you still sort of could remember caring about it enough that you were actually disappointed.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that's why all these wonderful variants on the various reasons that happened came out. It's that totality of the picture, I think, that makes the movie so, so interesting. Everybody... The three stars obviously are wonderful, but I mean, everybody in the movie contributes to that sort of world. And in that way, I think it's a satire. I mean, I would say it's a satire comparable, at least in its scope and its success, to Dr. Strangelove, which has the same kind of... It totally creates a world where logic is absent, completely absent. And the same thing in Spinal Tap.
Yeah, it reminds me a little I'm going to butcher his name, but Iannucci, he did, like, In the Loop. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
Contemporary now has done some work that is not quite the same scale, but In the Loop in particular reminds me of, like, a world where everyone is sort of working in something that they may have once been passionate about, but now we're sort of have a half a foot out the door.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what lends it its depth, and the same with Spinal Tap.
But it was funny because I was watching it the other night, and one of the, what you mentioned, that this has been, I mean, this technique has now really filtered throughout
right.
film and television.
And radio sometimes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But it's funny when in Tap, when somebody notices on screen that there's a camera present, because it looks so corny now, because everyone's done it on The Office and, you know, right. every other imitation of Spinal Tap. But it just Artie Fufkin is one of them. He goes, oh, well, I've got a, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, God. But anyway.
Right. So we're talking about slime balls. And I got to say, you know, what was interesting for me, having now worked in entertainment, if that's what I've been doing for the last million years, is your character resonates even more because you, as the band manager, have a unique sliminess that is sort of... you sort of have to tell lies to everybody in order to keep moving forward until, like, you can no longer lie anymore. When you sort of conceptualize your character, was liar part of one of the big words that drove it, or what sort of created that for you? Did you think of yourself as a good person in a bad situation, or a bad person in any situation? If that
well, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't really think about it very much until. Well, that's not quite true. I mean, I figured or modeled what I was going to do with this character on a guy called Andrew Lug. Was that his name? Andrew Lug Oldham? Andrew Oldham. He was the manager of the Rolling Stones. And he was very much, I mean, he was sort of a blonde, sort of two-faced kind of fellow. And with a much more pucker, upper-class kind of accent than his squatney East End of London charges.
Right.
So that seemed to be a fairly good model. But I must say, as soon as I started improvising, I remember it exactly. It was the scene at the beginning of the movie when they're in the limousine, and Ian is lying from the first moment he opens his mouth. He says the New York Times is going to do something, and then he says, "Well, we're not doing anything very much in New York because it's not worth it. But Philadelphia is a big rock town, you know." Mm-hmm. And it's just right from the start. He's sort of making excuses for things before they happen. And so, yeah, he's part of the structure too. He is the go-between between polymer slime and these poor morons who, you know, are traveling to where are they now?
Well, one of the things I always thought was interesting about Ian's character is that he, like you said, he'll say, "Oh, the New York Times gonna do something," and then he undercuts it. It struck me that he was the type that would always say something good, even if a second later contradicted it, and in part that was not just him lying, but him dealing with other characters, his charges, as you say, who are probably of the type of sociopath that only will hear the good things, that he kind of relied on being able to say, I'm going to give you $1 million. No, I'm not. And all they heard was, I'm going to give you $1 million, because they want to believe the best about themselves.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are many scenes like that. But one of my favorite scenes actually is the scene which before they go on wherever they go on may have been Philadelphia, where Nigel is worried about the food, the backstage food.
Oh yeah, and
Ian is very. He's very attentive, you know. It's not. He's not lying. He's actually trying to help poor moronic Nigel fold the meat around the bread in such a way that it might be edible. But then, you know, when Nigel starts getting worked up, he says, I don't want you to ruin your performance, you know. And he means it. He means it. He doesn't. Nigel's all he has, you know, and he's all Nigel has.
It's just the meat and bread holding them together.
Yeah. But you're right. Ian is a slime ball, and I did it brilliantly.
Yes, of course. What do you think? I mean,
although I must say, one thing I do want to say is that he is all they have. I mean, when Ian leaves, the band falls apart, and the only thing that rescues them is that he brings them over to Japan for another tour with, you know, more of the same slime, but it keeps them alive for one more round.
What do you think? Maybe this is my own prejudices towards where I my satirical viewpoint of the world is. But what do you think about Ian's role or other people's role in the movie, as far as like sort of the corporatism of either looming corporatism of music or just in general? Because in a way, Ian, even though he's the son of a slime ball, he is management. I mean, he's their manager, so he himself sort of has a corporate element. But yet oftentimes some of the trouble they have is dealing more with the big faceless corporation that we now today think of as corporate. Is it too much of me to try to force some sort of corporate criticism into Spinal Tap, or is that part of it, whether through Ian or otherwise?
No, actually, that's what I'm saying. I think is one of the reasons it has a kind of universal appeal, and a continuing appeal, because as you say, those slime balls are still with us and they're still screwing us and they still run the show, and they're just making vastly more money than they did then. But it's and the fact is that. The record company hovers sort of invisibly over the whole movie. It's not just in the occasional characters that show up from the record industry. I mean, and often Ian's job is simply to be the messenger of that. I mean, when he produces the Black Album, which doesn't even have their name on it, you know, and tries to enthuse about it, we're finally on our way, you know. And he's just doing his job, basically.
Right.
And the other, when they're in Memphis with Duke Fame, his horrible manager, he has to tell them they've been cancelled because of lack of advertising dollars. I mean, right. it's relentless.
There is sort of this element of the corporation or the record company as God. Like it's sort of Ian is struggling there and having to lie. But there's a sense that if the company really wanted to get behind it, they can make a star. I mean,
well, they could make it into Duke Fame overnight if they wanted to.
Right, yeah. And yet that doesn't happen. And you know, it is sort of fascinating. For some reason, I'm thinking of like American Idol and the fact that like how easy it is just to make a star instantly of talentless people that don't work, which is what Spinal Tap could have been.
Yeah, indeed.
At least Spinal Tap was hitting the road and trying. You know,
as Ian says. When they're told that they're not releasing the album at the beginning of the movie, he says, a clip here.
He keeps saying that a lot.
No, but I think that, I go back to this, the idea that you've just expressed, because it came out like in the height of the Reagan years, right? I mean, it came out in 1984 when sort of unchained capitalism and greed is good, was really roaring, and the corporations had sort of almost overnight, from being the villains of the piece in the 60s and 70s, were now the heroes, and so the satire has had a resonance then, and it still has that same resonance. But I think this might be one of the reasons, if I'm right, this might be one of the reasons why, and I can reveal this now on our show.
Reveal it.
That the principles of this incredibly successful movie. I mean, one thing you can say about it is that it's not only been pretty successful and a major cult all over the English-speaking world, and indeed in parts of the non-English-speaking world, like Germany and France. All the money that presumably has been taken in by somebody, in fact by a number of corporations, more than half a dozen actually, over the 30 years, not one cent of that has been enjoyed by the principals of the movie. No profit participation, although all of us had contracts guaranteeing profit participation. Not one cent of that has been seen. So they got their revenge. The corporation.
They did take out their revenge on the deep side. Although you're giving credit to the corporation to have been able to understand that there was a satire being done, as opposed to just
conspiracies exist.
This is true.
I know, because I can see someone behind you now.
This is true. It is. It's Sarah Palin looking over my shoulder at Russia. That's kind of amazing. And you did have contracts that said you get back. I mean, I know. Look, Hollywood reporting, quote unquote, is making sure that every expense just goes in lockstep with every piece of income. But that's kind of ridiculous.
The budget for this movie?
It was, what, like $12? I mean,
$4 million. Okay. Right. $4 million. It's probably one of the lowest budget, massive hit movies ever. And if there comes a point where if a movie costs $4 million and it continues to make money for 30 years, there's going to be some profit there somewhere.
And, you know, what I'm thinking, I have a friend, a comedian, who gets regular checks off of Mrs. Doubtfire, and he was in one scene in that movie. And, you know, and that's good for them for that particular movie being well run.
Sure, no, I mean,
that's crazy. I mean, have people made us think? I mean, obviously, you know, people have, everybody, yourself included, have sort of moved on, but like, still, was a stink ever raised about this? Did you guys ever get together?
No, certainly no public stink has been raised about it. And I think it should be.
Why do you think people haven't? Just because they've, whether it's...
I mean, it's not something that, obviously, the corporations involved. It's actually owned now, by the way, by Studio Canal. The French own Spinal Tap. The French own Spinal Tap.
Yeah, so they're getting their revenge on...
So they're getting some kind of revenge.
On somebody.
But it wasn't just, actually, not just profit participation in... There was one point in, like, the 90s when... obviously there was a lot of money coming in to somebody.
Right.
And I would get, at this point I think Fox, 20th Century, owned the movie. And I would get residual checks which had been redacted. I mean, you could see that there were 4- and 5-figure sums that had just been blacked out.
So you would get
canceled. But they sent the check anyway. It wasn't canceled. It was just redacted.
So you couldn't get, you couldn't get
it. Withheld the funds, exactly.
And did you when you got a check? I mean, you know, when you got a check for 4 digits that was redacted, did you call and say what is going on? Did you have?
I could never get any answer. But what the union didn't know why it was like that. You know, nobody knew. But they just basically they owed us this money in residuals because of the contracts.
Right.
You can't get out of the residual contracts.
Right.
But they simply refused to pay it.
Well, it strikes me that potentially, at some point, somebody made the decision to withhold it, and then each successive corporation has just seen, oh, well, this is how we do it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say.
This is Spinal Tap, after all.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That is, I mean, both Tony and I are smiling right now, but that's absurd. I mean, that's just obscene. First of all those checks could probably get us a nicer studio. And second of all, like that, I understand to a certain extent, you know, the stars that have gone on to successful careers and other things don't necessarily, maybe don't need to worry about the money, but it's even beyond the money. It's the principle of it, particularly this particular movie. Anybody that's a lawyer out there, I don't know what the number here is, but call us.
Right.
Wow.
Wow. Wow is right.
So what are we going to do about this? Are we going to make it won't be a Spinal Tap sequel, but... this screwed Spinal Tap?
I don't know. I think we should definitely do something about it. But you know, I mean, Rob and Chris and certainly Harry are all very successful guys, and I guess they just they haven't felt the need. I mean, I think they know about it. I mean, Rob certainly doesn't seem to be at all pleased about it. But
well, what was happening? I mean, it, give us. This
it's, but it is a very. It's also a very arduous process. I mean,
oh, I'm sure.
A friend of mine, Ron Shelton, who did Bull Durham and White Men Can't Jump, was royally screwed by Fox over White Men Can't Jump, and it took him forever to get even. You know.
Well, that's why people have lawyers and agents and managers.
Yeah, but it takes, you have to audit them. You have to go back years, you know.
Well, what happened in, you know, this came out in 1984. What happened in 1989? By then, you were already not getting residuals. I mean, like, or 1992, or, you know, what, you know, now it's 30 years later. So, yes, there's a lot of paperwork involved. But was this an issue that you guys were talking about? I mean, before everybody was as big as they all might be now or whatever, you said they moved on.
No, I mean, one thing was that the, well, this is ridiculously technical, but okay, let me start again. One thing was that the, certainly the grosses for this movie were nothing much, because when it came out, it didn't do very good box office. The significant thing about Spinal Tap was that it was sort of on the cutting edge of the VHS revolution, and that's what made it both a hit and a cult hit. So it when it started being put out on VHS and later on CD. On DVD, excuse me. And later on DVD, that's where the big money came. So that wasn't happening by the end of the 80s, or it certainly wasn't being accounted yet.
So it wasn't until. Well, what's interesting about that is that this sort of thought process was the basis of that writer's strike a few years ago. Was what's going to happen in digital? I mean, that answer still hasn't been. You know, resolved is somebody's going to make money. Somebody's going to figure out how to make money off of, you know, digital video or online video. And what happens if that's, you know, the person that writes Game of Thrones and the money? How anyway, I can't express it, but I'm saying like that. It's the same thing. The technology changes.
Yeah.
And the
creators get screwed.
Well, I'm upset for you. I don't know what I can do about it. I do have a law degree, and I'm a member of the California Bar, but I don't think I'm going to be the best guy.
I think we ought to go on as a sort of poor little Spinal Tap, you know, and go on Kickstarter and see if we can get enough money to really slap them. That's
well, would you raise money to fund a lawsuit, or would you just raise money to pay yourselves?
Because that's right. Why give it to the middleman? Yeah.
I think that'd be a great idea. We can do the Spinal Edition, as we were talking about. We can.
Yes, indeed.
That was Tony Hendra from This Is Spinal Tap and the Final Edition, and you've been listening to Cheater and the Rude on Progressive Radio Network.